This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. The week President Joe Biden took office, he signed a record 22 executive orders, many of them to undo actions taken by Donald Trump, like ending the Muslim travel ban and canceling the Keystone XL pipeline. Biden also called for the Department of Justice to stop renewing contracts with private companies that run prisons and pretrial detention centers.
A step we started to take at the end of the Obama administration and was reversed under the previous administration.
The step the Obama administration took was directed specifically at those private federal prisons, most of which are used to hold non-citizens convicted of federal crimes. People locked up inside had protested for years over poor conditions and medical negligence.
This is new at 10. An FBI affidavit details what happened during an almost eight-hour deadly riot.
Housing units set on fire. Inmates violently shaking the fence.
The inmate told us they want the public to know the reason they're doing this is because an inmate was sick and they don't believe he was given the proper medical care.
Even with the news coverage, the public didn't really know what was going on inside these prisons until Seth Fried Wessler of Type Investigations sued the federal government. He got an extensive set of prison medical files, and in partnership with Reveal and The Nation magazine, he started to piece together life inside these prisons. Today, we're going to bring you that investigation from 2016. Seth teamed up with Reveal's Stan Alcorn. They begin in Big Spring, Texas, a town on the edge of oil country, where one of these private prisons and a regular government-run prison sit side by side.
If you want to know what's going on inside a prison, you can't just walk in the front door and look around. But in the case of Big Spring's private federal prison, you can get a pretty good look at the soccer field. From the road, through a couple barbed wire fences, you can see men in khaki and white streaming out of a squat tan building, playing soccer, walking in pairs around the track. A short guy by the soccer goal is playing an accordion.
I've been looking into what happens in these prisons for years. This is the closest I've gotten to getting inside.
From here, Seth and I can see clues about what makes this prison different from the government-run prison next door. The inmates are mostly speaking Spanish. Again, they're all non-citizens. The sign out front says Geo Group Inc. That's the private company hired by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to run the place. But inside the prison, especially when it comes to medical care, the big difference is in the rules they have to follow.
Generally speaking, when prison experts talk about the Bureau of Prisons, they say that it's the best functioning prison system in the United States. But the kinds of rigorous policies that the Bureau of Prisons has developed to regulate staffing patterns and what kinds of workers do what in the provision of medical care, those rules aren't applied to the BOP's private prisons.
Seth wanted to find out how that affects patients, so he filed a public record request that got him over 9,000 pages of medical files and internal investigations, covering the entire history of these private prisons for non-citizens.
With handwritten notes from nurses and doctors, they're literally detailing minute by minute what's happening inside of medical clinics inside of these prisons.
Seth had doctors read all these files, and they found a pattern. Cases where lower standards and less qualified, less expensive workers came together to produce a medical disaster. Seth and I came to Big Spring to tell the story of one of those cases. But to understand what happened, it helps to start before things went wrong, when the guy in charge of healthcare was Dr. John Farquhar. Between 2010 and 2014, he was the one doctor for the more than 3,000 inmates.
Well, technically, I worked a 40-hour week, but you can't practice medicine on a 40-hour week. That's me.
Dr. Farquhar has rigid posture and a military haircut.
Hello.
And at 85 years old, he's still practicing medicine full-time, 7 days a week if he needs to.
I've always had a seven-day approach to medicine, and I didn't see anything unusual about that.
But he was unusual when compared to the other doctors in the prison medical files.
He was writing more notes than just about any other doctor in any of the other prisons. He was there all the time.
Whereas in other private prisons for non-citizens, medical notes were being written and medical decisions were being made by low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses with only a year of training.
And then I started reading what he was writing.
Some of Dr. Farquhar's notes start normally by describing someone's symptoms or vital signs, but then they just go off, railing against his bosses, especially when they blocked him from transferring inmates out who were too sick to take care of in his limited prison clinic.
In one case, he wrote, "This man will almost certainly die." And that the Bureau of Prisons would, he wrote, "rush to find someone to blame, blithely ignoring the casual and repeated ways he has been dumped onto Big Spring."
There are times when I was critical. I'm a critical person, starting with myself.
You actually wrote at one point, "I feel bad for his shabby care."
Well, I stand by that statement. I don't know who it's about, and I can't comment on any single record of any person. But there are times when the care was not what I wanted for any patient, period.
He told us there was constant pressure to keep costs down. For instance, early on, his higher-ups told him to look at the number of times the prison had paid for an ambulance to take an inmate to the hospital.
They said, "You know, is there a way that we can cut this down?" And I said, "Probably yes."
I could imagine that could result in a pressure to not call when somebody really needs to go to the emergency room.
That's always the risk. That's why professional judgment takes professional training and professional experience, because you can't leave it up to anybody.
When Dr. Farquhar was clinical director, he was the one making those decisions. He was effectively always on call, and doctors who reviewed the medical files said he seemed to be doing as good a job as he could. But after 4 years, he said he was very tired, and he quit.
And then not long after he left the prison, there's a case that exhibits all of the problems that he was worried about.
The case of Nestor Garay. Back in 1998, when he was 25, Nestor came from Mexico City to wine country, Napa Valley, California.
It's beautiful here.
Where he moved in with his parents, Alvara and Indy.
Hola, ¿cómo está?
Seth and I visited them at their house, just a couple blocks from the natural food stores and bike shops of Main Street, St. Helena. When Nestor first moved here, he was like peas in a pod with his younger brother, Enrique.
They say when we answer the phone, we sound the same and we smile kind of the same.
They worked out at the gym together, and they worked together at the Sunshine Food Market. Nestor was in the cheese section. Enrique cut meat. But while Enrique went on to get a better job, buy his own house, and become a U.S. citizen, Nestor just stayed in the same bedroom in his parents' house.
He was very strongly attached to my mom and dad. Yeah, to be with them is like a pet. He wanted to be with them the whole time. But in a good way, because Nestor was a good son and all that, regardless of his addiction.
His addiction. It started with alcohol, but turned to meth. He started dealing to support his habit, sold to an undercover cop, and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. And because he'd never become a U.S. citizen, at 41, he ended up in the private GEO Group prison for non-citizens in Big Spring. His parents have stacks of letters Nestor sent them from prison, each of them with a hand-drawn and colored cartoon on the envelope. There's a jack-o'-lantern for Halloween, an orange cat with a bow on its head opening a gift for Christmas. His dad, Indy, opens one.
Nada más para saludarlos y decirles que todo está bien aquí en Texas.
The letter starts, "Just to say hello and tell you all is well in Texas." And then, early one Thursday morning, Indy told us they got a phone call.
Me llamaron sus amigos de él, compañeros.
It was Nestor's cellmates, calling from inside the prison in Big Spring.
Una mala noticia.
With bad news.
Bueno, gracias por hablar conmigo,
Seth señor. Tracked down three of these cellmates, including Irineo Espinosa.
¿Con quién tengo el gusto? ¿Quién me habla?
Speaking by phone from Mexico, Irineo says it all started when he and the other men in the cell were asleep.
¿Alguna en la mañana?
At one in the morning, Nestor starts moaning. Irineo says Nestor is trying to speak, but he can only make signs with his hands. Irineo and the other cellmates carry him to a lower bunk and realize he's wet himself. They open the door and tell the guard outside that Nestor needs medical attention.
Llegó la enfermera como a la media hora.
Irineo says about a half hour later, a nurse arrives. It's licensed vocational nurse Gary Austin, the only medical professional at the prison that night. And it's his note that begins the medical file. It says, quote, upon arriving to inmate room, inmate lying on bottom bunk, looking straight ahead, but not responding to name. He writes that Nestor's sweaty. He has a weak grip on one side. And the cellmates think he's had a seizure. The cellmates are told to carry Nestor downstairs to the building's bare-bones clinic. And there, instead of calling 911, Gary phones the physician assistant who's on call that night, Russell Amaru. Russell's at home asleep, but he wakes up and over the phone makes two key decisions. First, he tells the nurse to give Nestor Dilantin, an anti-seizure medication. And then, when Nestor can't swallow the pills, the notes show he gives a new order. Quote, send back to unit and place on mattress on floor. So the cellmates are asked to carry Nestor back upstairs. But Irineo says...
Dijimos no.
The cellmates said no.
No. Él necesita atención médica profesional.
He says he needs professional medical attention. Ask for a helicopter, an ambulance, that can take him to a clinic so he can get the care he needs. Ultimately, Nestor isn't returned to their cell. So the cellmates go to sleep thinking Nestor was taken to a hospital.
Y al día siguiente nos damos cuenta que qué fue lo que pasó.
Irineo says the next day they find out what happened.
Que lo llevaron a otra celda.
Nestor was just brought to another cell nearby and was left on a mattress on the floor until the morning shift arrived. By now, 5 hours have passed since Nestor started moaning, and he's transformed. He can't move his right side. His attempts to speak have become smacking sounds. The morning shift nurse, a more highly trained registered nurse, calls the prison's clinical director, a doctor, and they send Nestor to the nearest ER, where a CAT scan shows a massive stroke. He's then helicoptered to the Midland Memorial Hospital. We wanted to find out what happened to him there, so Seth and I went to the hospital and tracked down the neurologist who treated him that day.
Hi, doctor.
Hey.
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
Dr. John Foster.
If someone comes in having just had a massive ischemic stroke, how soon would they need to come in here for you to be able to do anything for them?
Would to be anything aggressive to them within 3 hours.
So as each hour passes...
Each minute, you have thousands of brain cells dying.
And if someone does come in 5 hours later, what can you do at that point?
For us, man, nothing.
Nestor's parents say the prison finally called them that afternoon, but they didn't tell them that Nestor had had a stroke, much less the details they'd heard hours earlier from the cellmates. So the next day, as they were preparing to fly to Texas, Nestor's dad, Indy, called the prison to get more information.
What was the capitan name?
His granddaughter recorded some of the call.
Do you know how long you're going to be here?
I don't know, not sure. It depends. You know, how is Nestor?
I haven't heard nothing today.
In the hospital, Nestor was shackled to the bed, and two prison guards were keeping watch when his family arrived. His dad, Indy, his brother, Enrique, and his mom, Alvara.
Me controlé, no quise gritar, no quise.
When we got there, I restrained myself. I didn't want to scream. I didn't want to yell because I really felt that my son could hear me. I didn't want him to hear me upset.
Yo recuerdo que lo abracé.
As soon as my mom started talking to Nestor, my mom hugged Nestor and Nestor cried. That's something I'm never going to forget. Somehow he was still there.
But the doctors told them that tear was just a reflex. Nestor was already gone. He was brain dead. His body was just being kept alive by the life support.
Fíjense qué crueldad.
I mean, look at the cruelty here. It wasn't until after they took him off life support that they took the shackles off.
Como que dijeron, si todavía vives.
It was as if they were saying, if you're still alive, then you're under my control.
The prison did its own internal review of what happened to Nestor Garay, and we got a copy. It found diagnosis was delayed, treatment was inappropriate, documentation was unacceptably incomplete. When Nestor didn't get better, the nurse or the physician assistant should have contacted the prison's doctor or top nurse. In other words, many things went wrong. But according to the four physicians we had independently review the medical file, The right thing to do was simple.
Call 911 is what he should have done.
That's neurologist Carolyn Martin.
If he had gotten there right away, he would have had a chance of survival. Not getting there right away, his chance of survival was really terrible. The prisoner was right, they should have called 911.
One reason they didn't call 911 could be the level of training of the only medical professional at the prison that night, Gary Austin. He's only a licensed vocational nurse, or LVN.
LVNs are essentially supervised, so they are not working independently.
Roberta Lavin is a nursing professor who used to work at a government-run federal prison. She says LVNs are usually supervised by a more highly trained registered nurse. While that higher-level nurse would know how to help someone with a gunshot wound, say, an LVN would help after they'd been stitched up, when it's time to give out the next dose of painkillers.
Or it's time to change that bandage.
She says to put LVNs alone on overnights at prisons, responding to emergencies, may save money, but it endangers inmates.
Having a person who has a more narrow scope of practice and is less prepared to deal with emergencies, what you're doing is you're putting barriers between that person who may have a medical emergency and the care.
You don't see this barrier to care in the government-run federal prisons. They have rules that specify what LVNs can do. But those rules don't apply to these private prisons. In a statement, GeoGroup said they strive to meet all the same standards, practices, and policies of government-run federal prisons. But after interviewing corrections officials and reviewing thousands of pages of medical files, Seth found something different.
We see over and over again, low-level medical workers, often licensed vocational nurses, are providing the bulk of medical care. Doctors who reviewed the files raised questions about whether those licensed vocational nurses were operating beyond the kind of care that they're trained to provide.
Seth got the medical files of 103 men who all died in these private federal prisons for non-citizens. And doctors who reviewed those files and additional evidence said 25 of those men likely died as a result of inadequate medical care that they got in prison.
One of these cases, a man named Claudio Fajardo Saucedo, was seen repeatedly, over and over again, complaining of headaches and back pain and nausea, and was only ever treated with ibuprofen and Tylenol and sent back to his bed. And he's nearly only seen by LVNs.
In fact, there's no record of him ever being sent to the prison doctor. After nearly 2 years of this, he's finally sent out to a hospital where, within days, he dies of an AIDS-related brain infection. Doctors who reviewed the files said he should have been diagnosed with HIV long before. That case happened at another private prison for non-citizens, about 2 hours west of Big Spring, called Reeves. That prison was investigated by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, a watchdog for the Bureau of Prisons. And we described Claudio's medical treatment and death to the Inspector General himself, Michael Horowitz.
It certainly doesn't surprise me what you're saying.
His review didn't look at the use of LVNs, but it did look at the number of total medical staff. And it found that in 34 out of 37 months, the prison had failed to meet the minimum required by its contract.
I think it raises two concerns. How does it impact individual inmates, and what does it mean for their health and safety? And the second is, why was it happening for 34 out of 37 months? Why wasn't that caught before we showed up?
He's asking not just why this company was breaking the rules, but why the Federal Bureau of Prisons, which is supposed to enforce the rules, failed to notice any problems for 3 years straight. Since Nestor's death, his parents have kept his bedroom in their Napa Valley home the way he left it.
I'll be honest with you. We sleep in this room.
They sleep surrounded by Nestor's things. His mom, Alvara, shows us Nestor's pants in the dresser, his hat on the door. She picks up a pair of his gym shorts from the closet and smells them before she puts them back.
His clothes, I think we should get rid of it, give it to someone who needs it. But you want to keep him too?
That's Nestor's older brother, Carlos. And he wants to help his family move on. But he also wants to know why his brother wasn't taken to the hospital sooner.
I can make a list of people that were involved, but who's really responsible? Who's the boss? So I want an answer from the person who contracts these companies, and I want an answer from the warden.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons, which contracted GEO Group to run the prison, wouldn't agree to an interview and didn't respond to written questions. The GEO Group and its medical subcontractor, Correct Care Solutions, said because of privacy concerns, they were unable to comment on individual medical files. Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse who was at the prison that night, didn't return our messages. But Russell Amaru, the physician assistant who the medical file says gave the order over the phone to send Nestor back to his cell instead of a hospital.
Hi.
You Mr. Amaru?
I could be, and who are you?
Seth and I visited his house in a condo complex 40 minutes outside Big Spring, Texas.
Let me ask you guys a question. How'd you find out about me?
At first, he refused to speak with us.
You're not supposed to talk. That's one of the problems with the prison system.
But eventually, he led us into his kitchen and spoke for several hours because he wanted the world to know about all the other factors that he said prevented the medical staff at Big Spring from doing their jobs as well as they should.
There would have been a more aggressive care for that patient and other patients, too, if we had better training, better staff. It's just so many things are wrong there.
He explains the decisions he made the night Nestor died. Decisions doctors and the prison's own review said were wrong by pointing to a failure of communication. He says all the information he had was what he was told over the phone by Gary Austin, the licensed vocational nurse at the prison. Gary wrote in the file that Nestor was unresponsive and had a weak grip. But Russell says he was told something different.
He was up and communicating. It just, he was not real lucid.
And he pins that miscommunication on Gary's lack of training, the fact that he was an LVN, also called an LPN.
You had an LPN right out of school, new in corrections, trying to make an assessment. He did not have the skills. I don't blame them as the person. I blame the management system that puts him in that position.
It's easy to blame the person. And the four physicians who reviewed Nestor's file and the prison's own review did find fault with both Gary, the LVN, and Russell, the physician assistant. But if you blame only the person, you let the system that put them in that position off the hook. And the system that Russell describes is one that puts its staff and its inmates in a position that's always just one mistake away from a catastrophe.
Basically, what you have in essence is people that are undertrained doing jobs that they shouldn't be doing. We do not have an infirmary for 24-hour observation. Charts are often temporarily lost for a couple of days or a week or so. And so the companies that I work for, all the way up to BOP, they've got the model of how the place is supposed to be run, and they seem to allow it. And I know you want to ask me, what would I do to correct the problem? I'd close this whole facility down, and I'd start over again.
That story from Seth Fried Wessler of Type Investigations and Reveals Stan Alcorn. Closing down that facility seemed far-fetched when we aired this show 5 years ago. But that's exactly what President Biden is now calling for. The contract is up in November, and the Bureau of Prisons has been told not to renew it. Seth called up Nestor's brother, Enrique, to see what he and his family thought about that news.
I'm glad they're doing something about it.
But the change he hopes for is both bigger and more basic.
I just hope that after what happened to my brother, I just hope they have more medical available. Just treat other people, you know, with decency. Treat them as humans.
After the break, we turn to the question of where these prisons came from in the first place. It's a story of a major shift in criminal justice policy, and also a story of a father risking everything for his sons. That's coming up next on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Today, we're revisiting an investigation from 2016 into private prisons that hold non-citizens convicted of a federal crime. A lot of the time, that federal crime is crossing the border illegally. Former President Trump was infamous for prosecuting parents and separating them from their children. But prison time for crossing the border didn't start with Trump. It was ramping up through the Bush and Obama administrations as a part of a policy called enforcement with consequences. One man who lived with those consequences before the Trump era was Eloy Flores. In 2016, Seth Fried Wessler of Type Investigations and Reveal Stan Alcorn spoke to him. Stan asked how many times he'd crossed the border.
Maybe like 20 times or more.
So it's like almost once a year.
Yeah, pretty much once a year, two times a year.
Like most people in his situation, there really wasn't any legal way for Eloy to immigrate to the U.S. So he made the decision to cross the border without papers.
To get a visa in Mexico, you got to be a rich man or get bank accounts and own houses and good jobs.
When Eloy first crossed, he said he'd never even had a job. He was a teenager looking to escape from the slow, violent divorce of his parents. And so, New Year's Eve, 1990, he and six other guys waded across the Rio Grande naked.
Naked, yes. You got to get naked, and you got to get your clothes on top of your head. That way they don't get wet.
They get to the other side, Brownsville, Texas, dry off and put their clothes back on and walk to a Kmart parking lot. There, they squeeze into a beat-up Mustang of Eloy's best friend. But then the car won't start.
So we got to get off the car and we got to push it, the car. And behind us, across a border patrol. And they didn't even pay attention to us. He just crossed by.
I mean, they could clearly see you.
We are in the road. But wait till I tell you another time I've crossed the border. This is nothing. From 1990 to 2005, I think it was the easy ones. From 2006 to today is really hard to cross the border, yeah.
The story of how it got hard for Eloy is also the story of how those private prisons got filled. In a little bit, we'll hear how Eloy is doing today. But first, we're going to listen to our original story from 2016. It starts in that beat-up Mustang. Here's Stan Alcorn.
After they got the car started, Eloy and his best friend drove all the way from Brownsville, Texas, to Silver Spring, Maryland. That's where Eloy got his first job, standing outside a 7-Eleven at dawn, waiting for contractors to pull up in their trucks looking for workers.
We are like 150 guys waiting for one truck or two trucks. You are lucky if you get a jump on the truck. Because if you're asking for a painter, everybody was a painter. If you're asking for a carpenter, we are a carpenter, 150 guys right there. So as soon as the truck show up, man, you got to be ready and you got to jump on the truck.
This is how he spent his first few years in Maryland, jumping into truck beds, digging holes, painting houses.
I had no holidays, no Christmas, nothing. No stop, working every day. I was workaholic because I want to get better.
And his life did get better and better. He started his own painting company, he got married and had kids. He even bought a house in Baltimore County with woods in the backyard. And whenever he wanted to take a break, he'd just go to Mexico and then sneak back to the U.S.
Yeah, it was really easy. You can cross the border easy.
It was so easy, he did it once a year through the 90s. And then in 2008, he and his whole family went back for a few years. He wanted his four kids, who grew up in Maryland and are U.S. citizens, to experience their parents' country and learn their parents' language. Their stay in Mexico was supposed to end in 2011.
It was time to go back because all my children, they speak Spanish 100%. My older son is need to be go to the university. So it was time to go back.
Eloy and his wife planned to hire a human smuggler to help them cross the border, and then the kids would follow legally on a plane.
It was part of my plan, but I didn't make it because I find to cross the border is really, really hard.
In the 2 decades since he waded across the river to Brownsville, things had changed. The number of Border Patrol agents had increased fivefold, pushing the places to cross way out into the desert. Seth and I walked a tiny part of one of those routes in West Texas. It's a flat plain of sand and creosote bushes.
Was he by himself?
No.
This is roughly where Aloy and his wife were caught. Tracked down by footprints in the sand, they think. And then...
Security?
This is the Border Patrol station in Del Rio, Texas, where we walked through the process with spokesperson Enrique Vasquez.
And you're in our processing area.
Half the room is made up of holding cells, and the other half looks like a grim metallic version of airport passport control.
It's similar. They come up here, you interview them, you get their name, you get their basic information.
And then the agent sends almost every crosser to be criminally prosecuted for illegal entry. It's a program called Operation Streamline. It started here in Del Rio in 2005, but was soon adopted elsewhere on the border. To explain why it exists,
I'll let you step in on this.
He turns to Agent Joshua Spriggs from the Border Patrol's prosecution office, who says the idea is to create more of a deterrent than a simple deportation.
The desired outcome is that will affect them wanting to come back again illegally, meaning they know now if I go, they're just going to send me right back. Did it have the desired effect? Well, he's back again. So it didn't. So we need to try and find something else that maybe influences his decision to try and come back legally next time instead of crossing between the ports of entry.
And do you track that?
I'm sure we track everything. I mean, we have numbers for it. I don't have a number for you, but to say that it's effective, I would say yes.
The Border Patrol used to point to statistics showing that border crossers who were prosecuted were less likely to cross again. But they're now scrapping that measure because an agency watchdog pointed out they weren't checking if the effect lasted more than a year. Still, this policy of using the threat of prison time as a kind of psychological border wall, this is why Aloy and his wife were sent to federal court. This is a recording we got of the hour and a half in court for Aloy, his wife, and 82 other people charged with illegal entry. The voices you hear are from attorneys, a Spanish-English interpreter, and Magistrate Judge Victor Garcia. The defendants, who fill the jury box and even the benches for the public, are silent, except for the jingle of their chains.
All the immigrants, we're looking around. Everybody's locked up from the ankles, knees, waist, and each other.
They're all wearing identical jumpsuits and what look like paper surgical masks over their mouths. Aloy says they could only see each other's eyes.
That's why we are like a numbers now. We're not a person. We are numbers.
You are guaranteed a set of rights. You will be asked to waive them so that I can take your plea. These are your rights. Listen closely.
This is how the Streamline program works. In order to prosecute nearly every first-time crosser, nobody gets a separate proceeding. They're all processed as a group.
Yes or no, do you want to plead guilty today?
Courts have decided it would violate due process to have them answer questions in unison. So instead, the judge points to them one at a time.
Yes or no?
Which takes a little more than a minute per question.
Yes by all.
Okay.
The one place where each individual gets attention is for sentencing, because the sentences depend on the defendant's criminal history, which usually means have they tried to cross the border before.
Mr. Calderona, you're going to be the first one of many that I have today that you have a conviction for illegal entry.
The more times someone's been caught and convicted for crossing in the past, the more jail time he gets this time.
You got 8 days the first time. You're getting 4 months the second time. It's up to 2 years the third time.
That's time he'll spend in a U.S. prison before being deported back to his home country. After a few cases, these sentences start to blend together.
Guilty or not guilty?
But for Aloy,
Mr. Fritz,
Judge Garcia decides to give a little speech.
You're not being prosecuted for being a bad person or because you do not have good reasons. Most of the people here, if not all of them, have very good reasons to cross, to work, to support their families, to better educate their kids, sometimes to pay off debts. The problem that you have, like all others, is you do not have permission to enter. But because you have a prior conviction, to be consistent and fair, the sentence I give you is because you have a prior conviction, not because you've done something wrong to the United States yet. You don't have permission to enter. So you got to do 4 months in prison. The only reason it's 4 months is because maybe after you do that long in prison, you will not return. I don't know that. I cannot stop you from coming back. But I can tell you what will happen if you do, and that you're going to be in prison. I know 4 months is a long time, considering you need to get back to your children. Your wife is here as well. But it's a lesson for everybody else that you cannot cross. Those days are over. You understand?
Yes.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
No.
Thank you. Jesus Garcia Franco, 13.
Okay, come in. Seth and I visited Atlacomulco, a small town north of Mexico City. It was supposed to be Eloy and his family's temporary home, but they've now been here for 8 years. Their main source of income is an internet cafe sandwiched between a tortilla factory and an office supply store.
Yeah, this is my mall shop. I designed myself, and I built everything you can see.
Eloy built little wooden cubicles with saloon doors for the computers. But when we visited, none of them were occupied. Eloy's oldest son, Eduardo, was manning the front desk.
Basically, we just take turns. Right now, it's my turn.
When he's not working, Eduardo's studying engineering at a local Mexican college. As a U.S. citizen, he could go to college in the States, but it would be a huge expense. And his parents are just scraping by as it is.
Right now, they're both here and we're happy, but happiness isn't helping us pay for food, paying for our school, our tuitions, because university's hard. Even here, it's hard, and I'm going to a public university.
All right, now let's go.
In 2 years, when Eduardo turns 21, he can try to sponsor his parents for a green card so they could move to the U.S. legally. But because of their history of crossing the border and living in the U.S. without authorization, they'd likely be barred from the country for 6 more years. And so, even though last time he ended up spending 4 months in a private prison in Big Spring, Texas, Eloy is talking about crossing the border again.
It's not for me anymore. Now it's for my sons. They are U.S. citizens. My older son, he always dreamed about study over there. So that's why I feel guilty, because I fell in, not crossing the border.
Does the threat of being locked up in prison, does that make you think twice?
I make you think twice, but not stop it. Being locked up is only be slowed down. Sooner or later, we'll be there. I see a lot of friends, they're being locked up, spend 6 or 4 months, they're already in USA. So America is spending a lot of money. To give you a lesson, they don't work.
Criminal prosecutions of border crossing started to rise in the 90s when the federal government launched what it called Prevention Through Deterrence. John Clausen became the head federal prosecutor in Midland, Texas, in 2003.
Illegal immigration was, I don't know if it was skyrocketing, but there was certainly on the upswing. And so there was a lot of discussion, well, how can we stop it or reduce it significantly? What are some things that we might try?
The Border Patrol got more funding and more agents. Operation Streamline started, prosecuting more people for illegal entry. And John says he was told by his superiors to prosecute as many people as he could for illegal re-entry, a felony charge for crossing the border after being deported. He says it was all kind of an experiment in discouraging not only the people they sent to prison, but everyone those people knew.
The idea is the word would spread, that they would go back to their home areas in Mexico and they would tell everybody else, man, it's not worth it. Because if you cross, you're going to end up spending, you know, a few months in jail and it stinks and therefore don't come.
More than 70,000 people were prosecuted for immigration offenses in 2015. That's nearly twice as many as a decade earlier. In fact, more people were prosecuted for crossing the border than all other categories of federal crime. Drugs, weapons, white-collar crime, combined. But it's still only a fraction of the more than 300,000 people apprehended by Border Patrol.
And in general, why not prosecute everyone?
Because you can't possibly. I mean, if we were to prosecute every minute immigration offense, it would take up all of federal prosecutor's time, and we would not be able to devote our attention to other very serious criminal behavior which we're charged with addressing.
Three years after that interview, President Trump's Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, would vow to do just that.
If you cross the border unlawfully, even a first offense, then we're going to prosecute you. If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law. If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault.
Yeah, if you cross the border, you separate them from your child, from your kids. I know all that stuff.
I called Aloy in March, after Joe Biden took office. He says he never did try to cross the border during the Trump years, so he's still in Atlacomulco, though he's no longer running that internet cafe.
So I got my own company in construction.
Ah.
You know, the way I was working in U.S., now I'm working here, same thing.
Of course, the money isn't the same, which is one reason his oldest son, Eduardo, is still there, too.
Same house, same everything. Not much has really changed.
Is it the same bedroom?
Yeah, same bedrooms, different sheets and different blankets. That's the same room.
Since he couldn't afford college in the U.S., he's been finishing his degree in computer engineering at that local university, while also working with his dad.
Since he's taught me how to do everything from electricity to plumbing to drywall and paintings, I have a lot of other skills too than my engineering degree, so that's a plus.
He hopes that all that is enough to get a job back in the U.S. where he'd make enough money to rebuild a life there, maybe even get a master's degree, even though it would mean leaving his family in Mexico.
You know that you may make a lot of plans in life, but sometimes your plans don't always go the way you want to. And I've tried to, how do I say this, do what I can with what I got.
He doesn't think of Mexico as home. It's just where he is, in his old room, with a new poster on the wall that says, Sigue adelante. Just keep going.
That was Reveal's Stan Alcorn with Seth Fried Wessler of Type Investigations. After the break, we talked to someone who spent years trying to dismantle the systems that lock up immigrants. You're listening to Reveal. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Ledson. Today, we've been talking about how private prisons are used to hold non-citizens convicted of federal crimes.
A lot of the concern is that when you're looking at the federal system of incarceration, the system is racist by design.
That's Silke Shaw, executive director of the Detention Watch Network. She says those private prisons don't offer the same services as ones run by the government.
Rehabilitation services, job training, etc., and reentry services. So the idea is we don't have to spend resources on these individuals because they'll ultimately be deported.
But Shaw says these prisons are just one piece of a larger puzzle. She points to ICE detention centers, a whole system of jails for holding people not because they've been charged with committing a crime, but just because the government is trying to deport them. The Detention Watch Network wants to shut all these facilities down. President Biden's recent executive order on private prisons doesn't do that. It's focused on the Department of Justice. That means it affects the jails and detention facilities run by private companies for the U.S. Marshals Service and the private prisons that hold people convicted of federal crimes for the Bureau of Prisons, or BOP. In 2016, Obama's Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates sent a memo to the BOP, telling them to wind down their contracts with private prisons. But then Trump came into office and reversed that decision.
The memo that happened in 2016 said that these facilities would be phased out in 5 years. Ultimately, the reversal meant that none of these facilities ended up shutting down. It was like as if prior to August 2016, everything was the same. Like, we're just going to continue to use these segregated facilities for immigrants. We're going to continue to target immigrants four prosecutions for crossing the border without documentation.
So now, once again, we've got a president saying that it's time to stop contracting with private prisons. Does it feel like 2016 all over again?
In 2016, I think, you know, there wasn't a lot of visibility about the facilities that Bureau of Prisons uses for immigrant incarceration. And so it was interesting to see this response from President Obama, Sally Yates at the time, to say, okay, wow, we were sort of gearing up to say, how are we going to get these facilities shut down? And then all of a sudden there was this call to close. 4 years later, so much has happened. You know, you had the 2018 family separation zero tolerance policy that led to families being separated because of these migrant prosecutions. You had the uprisings last summer that really called to question the role of incarceration and policing in our society. So for Biden to come out and say, okay, I'm going to do this executive order on private prisons, you know, it's a good and important start, but it's so limited in terms of the scope of what could happen. And there's a few things that I would name that are, you know, disappointing about this order in particular. One is that the order says not renew. So the previous memo said we're going to phase out in 5 years, regardless of what the contract says. This one said not renew, and you have a lot of contracts that are longer than 4 years, and we don't know what's going to happen in 4 years. The other thing is that it only includes the Department of Justice, which was true in 2016. But when you look again at the last 4 years and what Donald Trump stood for and focused on in terms of xenophobia and racism and the expansion of immigration detention, and immigration detention specifically being where you have 80% of people held in private prisons, this order doesn't extend to that. So it's only focused on BOP incarceration and also U.S. Marshals incarceration, which is important, absolutely. But to have a real impact on the federal use of private prisons, you have to include ICE detention.
You know, it seems to me that, like, what's happening is that the Biden administration is dismantling parts of the infrastructure, but the infrastructure is still there. So in 4 years from now, if we get another president that disagrees with Biden's direction, they could reverse it and we'd be right back in the same situation. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think we could definitely see a reversal. I think that's a question on all of these things. I believe ultimately the more we can do to dismantle, the more we can do to get some of these facilities to close down, the harder it's going to be for a new administration to come in and roll back. And then additionally, I think there's a real need to shift some of the laws and policies. I think when you look at this segregated system for immigrants in the custody of the Bureau of Prisons, ending the prosecution of migrants for entry-related offenses is really key to getting permanent change on this.
So in the past, the Bureau of Prisons has ended contract with prisons only to have them turn into immigration detention centers. On an earnings call, one of these private prison companies said that they'll be able to recommission these facilities for other clients, like local or state governments. Could that happen with these prisons?
Absolutely. And this happens a lot between Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE facilities, and BOP or U.S. Marshals facilities, where there's just sort of a turnover. And so, you know, again, there is a huge concern that Biden not including ICE detention means that a lot of these facilities could become ICE detention centers. I do think that private prison companies are going to start really putting pressure. We're already seeing this in places like Alabama for states to take on more private contracts. And I think that's a real question, especially in states that are more committed to incarceration or committed to private incarceration.
As somebody who's working in the trenches on these issues, you know, what do you see the future being as far as, like, what are the dangers that we're heading towards?
I think we are in a place where, at least in the federal government, there's some actual desire to move to some degree away from, you know, the inherent racism of this system. I think there's so much to do on that front. I think one of the sort of risks here, though, is when you're looking at incarceration and quote unquote alternatives, a lot of the things that the federal government is putting out there are potentially more surveillance tactics in the immigration detention context, a lot more ankle monitors being used as an alternative, quote unquote, to detention. And so I think as we move forward, just really ensuring what does it mean to be free. What does liberty mean in this context, and ensuring that the systems that we put in place aren't something that sort of furthers those restrictions on liberty and freedom.
Silky Shaw is the executive director of Detention Watch Network. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That story was produced by Nomin Ojiadin. Today, we focused on prisons for non-citizens. But another huge issue facing the Biden administration is how to handle the surge of people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border and the detention of unaccompanied minors. Nearly half of those children come from Guatemala. Next week, we visit a small village in Guatemala to see why people are fleeing and why plans to address the root causes of migration have failed. That's next week on Reveal. This week, our lead producer was Stan Alcorn. A huge thank you to Type Investigations and reporter Seth Fried-Wessler. Esther Kaplan and Suzanne Reber edited our investigation. Victoria Baranetsky is our general counsel. Our production manager is Amy Mustafa. Score and sound design by the dynamic duo, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Fernando, my man, Yo Aruda. They had help this week from Claire Mullen, Brett Simpson, Joe Plord, and Amita Ganatra. Our digital producer is Sarah Merck. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Jonathan Logan Family Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Heising Simons Foundation, the Democracy Fund, and the In As Much Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson. And remember, there is always more to the story.